Esther chapter 4 tonight, the study of Esther, I find within the pages of this short book very, very intriguing and impacting truths. Although we have mentioned many times already that we don't see a mention of God specifically, or prayer or worship or sacrifices or offerings, but we see his providence, we see his hand working in so many different areas. And the picture that's painted in this story, the typology, if you would, that God draws throughout the pages of the story that we're in, even though these people are in Persia and don't belong there, they're not in the place God really intends them to be, yet God will use his sovereign power to work in spite of them. And boy, is that ever a truth that we can cling to. He uses us. He uses his sovereign power and moves in so many ways around us. He has to kind of push us aside occasionally and kind of get the thing done that he needs to get done. And we come to this place where we think, wow, look, the Lord used me in this. Well, he probably got it done and you happen to be in the neighborhood. It's more likely the scenario. So it's great to say, you know, we want God to use us and all the rest, but I need to point this out. The story of Esther is a story of people out of the will of God and God working anyway. And it's an important book and an important study for that reason, because I don't know about you, but, you know, if I want to do a real honest self-evaluation, how often am I out of God's will and how often am I in his will? And yet he's still God and he still does amazing things, doesn't he? Because he loves us and he's not affected in his purposes by the failures of his people. He will get it done. He will get his will accomplished one way or the other. And that's just the truth that's gone on through the ages. Now, what's happened? In the last chapter, if you recall, we met this man named Haman. Haman the wicked, who, again, just as a side note, his name, Haman the Wicked, in the Hebrew language has the numerical value of the Hebrew letters of 666. Just an interesting tidbit. And he does, by all kind of ways that you'd want to look at this man, in every fashion you'd want to kind of analyze his life, he does kind of foreshadow the one who will be representative of 666 or the Antichrist. He is one that is attempting to wipe out the Jews, which, of course, the Antichrist in the last days of the Great Tribulation will try and do the same thing. And Haman, this man who was appointed by King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes, he was appointed by the king to be just under the king in power and authority in Persia. And yet, we learned in that study last week that the king had to make a commandment so that people would honor Haman. Meaning that the people weren't going to honor him, bow to him, or give him any respect or reverence if they weren't commanded to do so by the king, because he didn't deserve any respect. He wasn't a respectful man. He just had a position that was supposed to be one that you would respect. And you know, I often tell people in our nation, that's just the way it is as well. We may not respect the man holding the office that we are looking at, like the president or the governor or any other position, but you need to respect the office, even if you don't respect the man. And that's just, you know, that's just the way it is. Paul says, look, just give honor to those that are in power. God put him there for a purpose. He can raise him up and take him down when he sees fit, but you just need to say, okay, God's in control, you know, and I'm not crazy about that guy, but I'll respect the office that he's holding. See, but this is the king's command to have Haman be respected, but, you know, nobody would do so otherwise. And Mordecai, the Jew, we found finally reveals that he's a Jew. He's the cousin of Esther, who is now the queen, and he is not willing to bow down to Haman. So when Haman comes down the street, everybody else is bowing down to him, And here's Mordecai standing there saying, no way. And it gets Haman's goat. Haman gets very upset. And people are telling Haman, hey, you know, this guy Mordecai never bows to you. And so Haman discovers that Mordecai is a Jew. And therefore, because he hates Mordecai, then he hates all the Jews and wants to destroy them all. Has the king really draw up this edict that will basically declare that the Jews are to be killed on a particular day? We saw that last week. It would be open season on the Jews on this particular day. And, of course, the Jews that heard about it were stunned. And even the Persian people in the land, they were perplexed. They didn't understand what was going on. Why are we going to kill the Jews? Now, keep in mind something here, folks. This is important. In Persia, at this particular time, apart from those that have gone back to the land of Judah, back to Jerusalem, in Persia at this particular time, there are approximately 15 million Jews. They are all to be killed in one day, according to this decree that the king signed. Basically, Haman signed it with the king's ring, the signet ring. Remember, it was given to him. So here they are, the Jews, hearing the news that on this particular day that was chosen, you know, March 14th, they're going to be killed, every single one of them. And it says there, after the decree went out, in verse 15 of chapter 3, the king and Haman sat down to drink after the news was given out to all the provinces. But the city, Shushan, was perplexed. People were stunned and perplexed. What does this mean, and why are we doing this? Well, Satan's behind all this now, you see. Now, we pick up the story in verse 1 of chapter 4. When Mordecai, this is the Jew, the cousin of Esther, perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. Mordecai gets the news of what has been decreed and the king's permission given and granted, and he puts on sackcloth and he rents his clothes or rips his clothes and puts ashes on top of his head. Well, you say, what in the world is he doing? Well, this is the most extreme sign of grief that you could display. You would be grieved like this if someone close to you had died. You would grieve with sackcloth and ashes. And you would basically moan and cry and weep like you were grieving a lost loved one. And so this is what Mordecai does. Now, this is not only showing his grief over what has been decreed, but this is showing strongly his opposition to this law that's just been implemented. Mordecai's so distraught because of this, folks. The law that's been laid down here, according to Persian law, cannot be changed. It cannot be reprimanded back. It can't be taken back from existence now that it's been decreed. It's just the way the law worked in Persia. You could not change it. So Mordecai knows that. Something radical has to happen here in order for the Jews to be saved, or else they are going to be annihilated. And so Mordecai is grieved and puts on sackcloth and ashes and begins to cry with this bitter cry. Now, this is a picture of something that's very interesting to me. The decree came down, if you would. It's posted in every province, in every village. It's nailed up on the bulletin board in every town square. You are going to die, basically, is what it is saying. You're going to die. Now, it's interesting to me because what Mordecai does is what every person should do when you hear the same news. Meaning this, the decree that comes down that's posted everywhere you look is what? You're going to die. The wages of sin is death. And here, Mordecai hears this news that we are doomed, we are destined to die just because of who we are. By the way, folks, every person on this earth is destined to die just because of who they are. What are they? Sinners. You see, everybody is a sinner. Therefore, everybody is subject unto death because the wages of sin is death. And Mordecai here does exactly what a person's supposed to do. Grieve. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus said. Blessed are they that mourn. Grieve. Here, he mourns, grieves, and cries out with a cry that's piercing. This is exactly what a person needs to do when they hear the death sentence of life. Same thing. Now watch. By the way, Haman knows the condition they're in. He understands what this means. He's not ignorant of the law of Persia. He knows. And I believe every person in respect to this other reality that we see here knows the same thing. Everybody knows, you know, the wages of sin is death. Everybody knows that. There's not a real mystery about it, is there? Everybody realizes it. Nobody really wants to look at it, especially those that haven't cried out, so to speak, haven't mourned their sin and grieved their sin and cried out to the Lord. Now, came, verse 2, even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. So he can't come inside the gate where he normally hangs out. Not allowed to come in there with sackcloth. You're not allowed to grieve there. And in every province, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, and fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. All over the whole region that was ruled by Persia, Jews everywhere, when they got this news, put on the sackcloth and ashes and grieved and mourned and did exactly what Mordecai is doing there at Shushan, outside of the palace, because the same reality has hit them all, you see. Now, you may have noted something here that's a clue to whether or not the Jews living in Persia had any prayer life whatsoever. Because again, we don't see directly anything going on spiritually. However, here, when the news comes, what do we see them doing? Fasting. Now, when you read the Bible, folks, understand this. You cannot disconnect prayer and fasting. Fasting is the epitome, if you would, of serious prayer. When a person fasts and prays, that's when they're really serious about something. You know, you don't just stop eating. At least I don't. Unless you've got something really serious to contemplate, right? Who's going to just stop eating? Not me. But when you've got something that you're really, truly seeking the Lord about, you will fast. And we see here a hint that the people were fasting and praying. Can't disconnect fasting from praying. So again, the people were disconnected. Don't you find this is true, though, too? Even when you have been disconnected out of God's will, perhaps in Persia when you should be in Judah, so to speak, don't you find that this same reality is true? Even though you may be out there and you haven't really been close to the Lord at all, yet when trouble comes, when you hear the severity of what's going on around you, sometimes the situation you find yourself in, doesn't it cause you to get serious real quick, like these people are? There's nothing like a good trial to get you praying again, is there? There's nothing like a good issue of life to just come hard and heavy to make you go, ooh, I got to pray now. And that's what we see happening. Now, by the way, this whole decree, just like the end times, Jacob's trouble, the great tribulation, what is that? That is God's last attempt to get the Jews back. It's judgment, but it's judgment with mercy. God is pouring out judgment in those last days. Why? So that the people will wake up and come. Here, he allows this to take place. This is part of God's sovereignty to allow this declaration to be made. Why? So that the Jews living in Persia who are out of his will go, maybe we're in the wrong place. Maybe we live in the wrong country. Oh yeah, you do. You're supposed to be living in Judah, but you're living in Persia, and God's allowing you to get a wake-up call. And isn't this faithfulness? Don't you find the same thing happens to you when you're out there and you're out of the will of God and you're kind of living in this lifestyle that's not quite what God wanted for you? And he'll allow something to happen like this, perhaps, to get you waking up to the fact that you're in the wrong place. So here they are, mourning and grieving. So, verse 4, Esther's maids. Now, Esther here is safely tucked away in the palace. She has no idea that this decree has been made. She has no clue. Her maids and her chamberlains came and told it her. Then was the queen exceedingly grieved. They came and said, you know what? There's a problem in the kingdom. This decree has been made and the Jews are all going to be killed on one day. So the queen was exceedingly grieved and she sent raiment to clothe Mordecai. So what they told her was, hey, there's this thing going on. Mordecai, your cousin, is in sackcloth and ashes. He's grieving. Now, what she does here is a sign, is a signal to us that Esther was a little embarrassed that Mordecai was doing this. Why would I say that? Well, because she sent raiment to him, a new suit of clothes. She sent to him a new suit of clothes. Get out of the sackcloth and put on a new suit. Don't sit there grieving. Why would Esther do that? Because it showed how opposing Mordecai was to this whole thing. This could be in trouble for Esther. She's the queen. Everybody knows that Mordecai and her are close. See, she's not, again, revealed the fact that she's a Jew. Mordecai has already done so and now is really showing his colors. But here's the thing. What Esther does here on the immediate basis is what a lot of people do when the reality hits. Hey, what's the decree? We're all going to die just because of who we are. And when Esther hears that and knows that Mordecai's grieving it, she wants to send him a new set of clothes. Why? To cover it up. Cover it up. What she's suggesting here is what so many people try to do, and that is they want to put on a new suit when they hear this whole reality issue of death that comes from sin. But I'll tell you something, folks, religious covering will not do. What he's doing is absolutely correct. What she's suggesting is religiosity. Put on the clothes and pretend like you're not really grieved over this thing. So many times, religion is a cloak over what is really needing to be exhibited. I find that brokenness in the body of Christ is not something that's seen often enough. I think we have too many religious clothes that we're wearing and not enough broken grieved hearts, because it's much more suitable, get it, to put on the clothing and just kind of say, hey, you know, we're all right, we're okay, we're, you know, we're doing fine, hey, got the, you know. And this is what Esther's really doing. Put the suit on, Mordecai, don't do this, don't act so grieved out there. And you could think maybe she's trying to encourage him. She's trying to make him stop it because it's too obvious. Does this ever happen? Religion does this to people, folks. Stop it. You're getting too real. Stop it. This is getting too real. You're getting too real here. Don't do that. What are you doing? You're not crying, are you? You're not broken, are you? You're not sorry about sin. You're not repenting and confessing and doing all that, are you? Stop it. Here, put on some clothes, you see. Put on a new suit. We don't wear suits here generally. But, you know, if you want to wear a suit, you're welcome to wear a suit here. You know, we'll pray for you when you come in with a suit. But here's the thing. The suit is such an interesting thing to me because I grew up, when I was in church as a little boy, we always wore suits. Even I wore a suit. You know, when you're a kid, you have to get your suit on. Little tie. I used to have the clip-on kind. I still don't know how to tie a tie. My wife has to tie a tie for me. I don't have a clue how to tie a tie. You know, you might think I'm embarrassed about that. I'm not. So, everybody wore a suit, but I always remembered, and maybe you do too, if you went to church when you were a kid, or maybe, you know, a year ago or something, I don't know. If you used to wear a suit or dress, it was so interesting, wasn't it? As soon as you got done with church, what did you do? Changed. What a statement. As soon as I get done with church, I'm changing. Right? I'm going to change my clothes as soon as I get done with this. And some people, listen, this is what's taking place here in a sense with Esther's suggestion. Hey, just put on the suit of clothes, because you can take off that religion and hang it up just as quick as you put it on. And that's what I used to do. I'd take that suit off and hang it up in the closet until next Sunday and touch it all week long. Never wearing that anywhere except for the church. And some people are that way. I'm never wearing this except for church. See? So here, Mordecai hears what she says, sees the messenger come with the new suit of clothes. Here, Esther says, put this on. Take away the sackcloth from him, she said. Verse 4 goes on. But watch, he received it not. He said, no, take the clothes back to her. I don't want them. I'm going to remain in the sackcloth that I'm in. I'm going to remain in this condition until what? What's he saying here? Well, until there's no need for me to grieve anymore over this. This is the issue, isn't it? When the Lord reveals something that is really kind of a tearing at your heart, tearing at the inner part of your soul, you just grieve over it. And I highly recommend it. I highly suggest to you that when the Lord wants to break something, let him break it. David said, Lord, that the bones that thou hast broken may rejoice. You want to break a bone? Break it, and I'll rejoice over it, because that's real. See, I find that oftentimes believers don't rejoice because there's not enough reality in their life. And I'm not talking about just real stuff happening. Real stuff happens to us all. But the reality of what is going on here in this context, brokenness over the condition that we're in. And Mordecai will not take a religious covering and set aside the reality. He won't do it. Got to respect him for that. So then verse 5 called Esther for Hatak, one of the king's chamberlains, or one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend upon her. It's kind of her personal eunuch. And he is there for her to just use as a messenger, or go get her this, or she's just a personal, you know, he's just her personal, you know, gopher, so to speak. He's go get this, go get that. He's appointed to attend upon her and gave him a commandment to Mordecai to know what it was and why it was. So she's now aware that there's something to grieve. There's a problem in the kingdom, but Mordecai, you got to stop this. You can't act like this. And so he sends the clothes back and doesn't want them. And she says to this eunuch, you need to go find out exactly what's going on with him. She may have thought, she may not have even made the connection of what was going on. When she's grieved here, there in verse 3, it very well could be that she was told that Mordecai was out there in sackcloth and ashes. She grieved over that. Because now she says, what is it and why is it? Exactly what is it that he's grieving about? So Hatak, verse 6, went forth to Mordecai unto the street of the city which was before the king's gate. And Mordecai told him of all that had happened unto him, and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the Jews to destroy them. Remember, Haman offered to pay some $20 million to the king for the privilege of killing all the Jews in the nation. So this is what Mordecai now reveals and sends this message with Hatak back to Esther. Also, he gave him the copy, verse 8, of the writing of the decree Now, this indicates, again, what I suggested earlier, that maybe Esther didn't really know anything about this. She just heard that Mordecai was grieving and maybe thought that somebody had died or something. But this shows that she really didn't have a privy to that declaration, that document that was floating about. But Mordecai had a copy, and he gives it to this messenger, a copy of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and to declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him, and to make request before him for her people. Now, oops, for whose people? Her people. Now, this eunuch has just heard from Mordecai that Esther is a Jew. Nobody knew that before. So now this chamberlain or this eunuch, now he's got a dilemma on his hand, doesn't he? What am I going to do with that information? Now, he's a fair man, I believe, because he obviously does not take that information anywhere else, like to Haman or even to the king. He must have some respect for Mordecai and for Esther. Now, some have suggested that maybe this eunuch, this chamberlain, was a Jew himself, and Mordecai knew it, and therefore could trust him with this information. Maybe it wasn't a whoops. Maybe it wasn't a slip of the tongue. We don't know. But nonetheless, he says, hey, this is for her people that she could do this. She needs to go see the king, go get in his face, and tell him what has taken place with Haman and this whole scandalous thing that's going on. She needs to go in to see the king. Hatak, verse 9, came and told Esther the words of Mordecai. And again, Esther spake unto Hatak and gave him commandment unto Mordecai. So she hears what Mordecai has to say, and then she immediately says, now you need to tell Mordecai this. All the king, verse 11, she says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know, in other words, everybody knows, that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death. Doesn't matter who it is, even the queen, you cannot just barge in unannounced, uninvited, uncalled into the king's presence and just start making requests and start talking to the king like he's just some schmo. That's what she's saying. It's one law and it covers everybody, including me, she tells Mordecai. Except, everybody would be put to death except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter that he may live. If the king sees you come in and holds out the scepter, then you're spared your life. If he doesn't, the guards take you right then and kill you. That's it. So you're taking a real chance. You go see the king uninvited, and no scepter being held out, you're done. You're a goner, you see. But I have not been called, she said. Verse 11 goes on. I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. I haven't even seen him for a month, she says. Seems as though maybe, you know, Esther's lost her appeal with the king a bit. She hasn't been called in to see the king for a month. You know, well, you know, you got to figure that he's got a harem, right? This is just part of the deal for a queen of this kind of dynasty. You know, he's got hundreds of other women to choose from whenever he wants. So she hasn't seen him for a whole month. And this isn't the kind of marriage where you just kind of hang out with each other all day long. She's living in the harem with the other women and the eunuchs. And if perchance he says, bring my queen, then she comes to see him. Otherwise, there's no relationship at all between these two. So she says, I haven't even seen him for 30 days, for a month. And so they told Mordecai Esther's words. So the messengers are going back and forth like a ping pong ball. And they're telling now Mordecai what she says. Now watch. Then Mordecai commanded to Esther. And he says, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. You're a Jew, and he says here, don't think that you're going to escape what's coming down on the Jews just because you're in the palace. Because we know from Haman's hatred, he's going to hunt down every Jew and would probably take special interest in finding out that Esther, the queen, is a Jew. And so Mordecai says, don't think you're going to be spared because you're just in the palace. If you're a Jew in this country come the middle of March, you're going to die with the rest of us. Now, is he threatening her? No. He's telling her the truth. This is her cousin who raised her when her parents died. He has always told her the truth. He's always told her things that would be for her benefit. And he's telling her this so she wouldn't be deceived, thinking that somehow she's going to escape this. Now, she's indicated, basically, in what she said, that she doesn't have any interest in going and seeing the king. I don't have any desire to die in the court of the king. But he says, that's not an option. If you don't, it's not an option. You're not going to escape. For if thou altogether, verse 14, holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Now here's another hint or clue that Mordecai was trusting in the Lord, even though he was in Persia, not in the place he's supposed to be. Because where in the world would deliverance come from? Does he think that some body is going to be raised up? Does he think that somehow? I don't think so. He says, look, if you don't do this, if you don't take part in this, then deliverance will come from somewhere else. Now, what's Mordecai drawing that information from, and what is he getting at? Well, he knows, Mordecai knows the history of the Jews. He knows that they've never been annihilated, nor can they be, because of God's covenant and promise. So he knows good and well, if Esther doesn't do this, then somehow they're going to be delivered. It reminds us, doesn't it, of the covenant God made over and over with his people. If this didn't work out, if this plan was unfolding and the Jews looked like they were going to be wiped out, sometimes it would come down to one person. Remember Joash? One heir left. And God said, that's all I need to keep the line going. He will not allow this to happen. So here, Mordecai knows that somehow, Esther, if you don't take part in delivering these people, then somehow we will be delivered. Again, another clue that he really does trust in the Lord, even though it's not evident in his life. I wonder how true that is of Christians, oftentimes, trusting the Lord, but doesn't seem to be real evident in their life. You know, I'm not the judge, and you're not the judge. I'll tell you something, though. If we knew Mordecai personally and we knew these people living in Persia personally, we'd probably judge them. If you lived in Judah in this day, this was going on. If you had been one that went back to Jerusalem to help rebuild, you may have a view of those Persian dwellers, you know, and say, what are they doing? What are they doing over there? They're supposed to be back here, you know? Brother, but we're not the judge. And just because, listen folks, just because it's not evident in someone's life doesn't mean they don't know the Lord. It could be like Mordecai, they are in the wrong place and been in the wrong place for a long, long time. But if God knows them, it doesn't matter what you think. If God's working in their life, it doesn't matter what you think. It just matters that God has them. Pray for them, love on them, share with them, don't judge them. So, Mordecai says, hey, deliverance will arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. In other words, you're probably, you know, in very, very grave danger being that close in because Haman and the king here are conspiring, and you could very well be destroyed. And who knoweth, he says, whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Talked about this on Sunday. Mordecai says, you know, Esther, who knows? Maybe Now, I think Mordecai is starting to put the pieces together of what has been going on with him and Esther for all these years. And now he kind of puts it together and says, who knows? Maybe you've come into the kingdom. Maybe you were made queen by the hand of God so that you could be in that place right now for such a time as this to bring deliverance to your people. Who knows? Maybe that's why you're here. You know? Well, what a statement and what a truth it is for all of us. What are you doing here? What am I doing here? Why are you living in this town? Why are you living next to those people? Why are you in this church? Why are you in this community? Why are you still on the earth for such a time as this? To bring deliverance to people that are around you, you see. That's the purpose. That's what he's saying to her. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. So she hears what he says. And you can just see Esther going, ah, that hurt. He got her, didn't he? He got her. Who knows, Esther, for such a time as this? Sunday got me. I don't know about you. But he drives this point home, and she hears what his heart is saying. And he gets her, and she says, tell him this. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me. What does that mean? Pray for me. Not just pray lightly. Fasting, again, the most serious form of dedicated prayer. When you pray and fast, it's serious. She says here, gather every Jew, everybody, every one of God's people, so to speak, that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days. I want a 3-day fast taking place for me. I want prayer going up for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days. 3 days, folks. The third day, the resurrection from the dead. She says now, pray for me for 3 days. Fast. I need that prayer. And then the third day, you see, we'll see what happens. Night or day, don't eat. Fast for me. Pray for me. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Now catch this. The statement that she makes. I need you to fast and pray for me for 3 days. At the end of that 3 days, then what? Then I will go in, but not according to the law. 3 days, the resurrection, the living coming back from the dead, so to speak. And here she says, hey, I'll do this, but it's not going to be according to the law. There shall be no flesh justified by the works of the law. What's happening here is she says, look, this is not the law. The law is not going to get this done. If it's the law that's going to happen, I'll be dead before I get through that door. But this isn't going to be according to the law. This is going to be according to you praying and fasting for me for 3 days. And then I'll go in, not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. She's saying, if it kills me, if it kills me when I go in there, then so be it. Then I'll die, but I'll die in the attempt to deliver our people. She is a picture of the greater than Esther, isn't she? Jesus didn't just say, if I perish, I perish. No, he said, I came to give my life as a ransom for many. Not if I perish. Oh, I will. I will. Not according to the law. I'll blow the walls out of the temple. I will rip the veil down from in between the holy place and the holy of holies. I will completely nail the law to the cross, and I will perish, and many will be ransomed as a result. The deliverance would come, you see. This woman, Esther, this one that was placed there by God for such a time as this to be drawn from. Do you ever think about that? Do you ever think how so often God has done something, put things in place? He put you here, he put you there, put you there, put you there, put you there. And all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, this is the time. This is the moment that all this was laid out for. All the foundation and all the preparation and all this stuff. It was for right now. And this is her moment, isn't it? And she comes to that conclusion. I believe the praying and fasting, she realizes, this is my time. This is why I'm here. I wonder sometimes, folks, if we shouldn't just spend a little more time just praying things in that perhaps the Lord might reveal to us our time for something special. So verse 17, Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. He went and gathered everybody and they started fasting and praying. In the next chapter, we'll see what Esther fulfills in the things that she was really placed in that position to do. Now, before we quit, I just want to point this out. God sovereignly, faithfully, has put these things in place so that he could do something that was out of the realm of imagination of the people that were involved in this process. Mordecai, Esther, and the rest of the Jews living in Persia did not know what God was up to. They didn't know what he was up to when Esther was made queen. They didn't know when this decree came down that all the Jews must die. They didn't know what God was doing. In fact, they were probably very perplexed that God was even allowing any of this to happen. They probably didn't have a clue what to do about it. But yet God was doing stuff anyway, kind of working things all together in this scene to accomplish what he needed to. And eventually, what we're seeing here is Esther and Mordecai are finally catching up a little bit to what God's been doing the whole time. Do you ever feel like that? Like all of a sudden you see something, you go, oh. And you feel like you've just got to catch up a bit because you feel like you're way, way behind perhaps what God's already doing. And you are. And I am. We're way behind. You ever feel like you're out of the loop? Oh, man, we are. We don't know what God's doing, but we trust what he's doing, whatever it is. That's the idea. I have no idea what God's doing in everybody's lives. But I do know this. He's faithfully doing all kinds of stuff, and all things are working together for good for those that love him. And someday, we'll catch up. Heaven's going to be a big catch-up session where we'll just look around and God will reveal all these things and we'll go, oh, wow, huh, who would have thought, you know? Man, Lord, you did all that, you know. He's so faithful. And even when we're not where we should be, he's so faithful, isn't he? Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word and just for the grace and mercy that's seen woven into these stories and these pages in the Bible. How often, Lord, you show us the reality of what you're doing, even though the people that you're doing it with don't have any idea what that is. And really not all that necessary sometimes for them to know, because you know. You know all things. You're in control. And if that's so, then we can rest. We can be at peace. We can just sit back and say, Lord, have your way, and whatever you want to do with us, so be it. And I pray that, Lord, we would have the heart, the mind, and the insight, Lord, into this particular truth to just say amen to whatever it is you want to do. Tonight, Lord, I thank you that we can come to the table and take in that wonderful, amazing, powerful remembrance of Jesus. Once again, remembering the sacrifice. It was your power, Lord. It was your redeeming power that brought us to salvation. And we remember that tonight by going and taking again the body and blood in that remembering way. Again, just simply acknowledging who you are and what you've done. So we come. Bless the table. Bless this time. As we worship, as we take communion, just be honored in it, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.